Chapter 8. Violence. I just got beat up by the crowd. No police at all. These were my first words as I recorded a live stream video on Twitter on June 29th, 2019, outside the Multnomah County Courthouse. Sitting on the ground because I was losing balance, I saw my bloodied face and swollen eyes on my phone screen. Beside me was BuzzFeed news reporter Joseph Bernstein. I asked him to call the police because he'd witnessed my beating. I was dazed and confused. Did this really just happen? I thought to myself. I was also angry. Where were the police? Before the beating, I had already reported two instances of assault by Antifa to law enforcement. While recording the demonstration earlier at Lounsdale Square, a masked male had run up behind me and slammed a cup filled with a viscous white liquid on my head. One of the rally's organizers that day was Popular Mobilization, or Pop Mob, a new Antifa group. Pop Mob gave out what they said were vegan milkshakes. I saw their volunteers pouring the drinks into paper cups from industrial buckets. The paper cup used to hit my head had the Iron Front's Three Arrows logo printed on it. I reported the assault to a nearby Portland police officer who stood watch on the periphery. A stringer and friend for the Federalist news site who witnessed the incident photographed the suspect and pointed him out to police. The officer let me know that he could take a report but would not approach or question the masked person. The first minor assault was meant as a warning by Antifa that I needed to leave. I thought about the implications for following their demand. Local television crews have been attacked by Antifa militants before and now only record footage from a far distance away with security. If I left, it would cede the public space to Antifa and set a precedent that I could be threatened to leave. I stayed. A group of Black Bloc militants began following me and preventing me from working by physically blocking my path. I ignored them and walked around as needed. They followed, whispering to one another and appearing to take orders from someone else. Nearby, police approached a masked individual who came armed with a metal bat. He initially refused to turn it over, but eventually discarded the bat under a car. He was not arrested. Worried about the potential for violence, I had earlier asked Bill Bradley, the owner of a local martial arts gym, to be my security in a worst-case scenario. The longtime Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, member had standing with left-wing activists in the city. He disagreed with some of my views, but supported my right to document public events unimpeded. I'd never sought out security before, but following the incidents of Antifa violence against me in the month prior, I needed to take additional steps to protect myself. On May 1st, 2019, also known as May Day, Antifa and left-wing protesters rioted outside Cider Riot, an Antifa pub in northeast Portland. While recording the incident on my phone and standing behind a nearby van for cover, a masked woman in black sprinted and maced me directly in the face. I was blinded and retreated from the riot. My skin burned for days from the chemical spray. The assault was on camera, and I reported the attack to police, but no suspect was ever identified. I naively thought I was prepared by bringing along one plainclothes security escort. It was a bonus that he was known as a leftist. But Bill Bradley's relationship with many of the people there proved to be a critical vulnerability. They screamed and yelled at him, accusing him of protecting a fascist and betraying the community. One of the people who shouted at him was an ex-girlfriend. The goal to isolate me worked. Bradley got cold feet, pulled back, and withdrew. I didn't see him again after he left Lansdale Square. Soon, another person walked up to me and threw another cup of liquid at my face. The white substance splashed under my goggles and went into one of my eyes. I reported the assault to the same police officer. His response did not change. The protesters began marching, and I followed them. If all they were going to do was throw drinks at me, I could handle that. At least that's what I thought. The protesters cycled through banal chants against police, fascism, racism, President Trump, and the Proud Boys. The day's protest was organized by Rose City Antifa and Pop Mob to counter a flag-waving event by right-wing pro-Trump fraternity the Proud Boys held on the other side of downtown. The DSA Portland chapter showed up with red banners to march alongside their comrades. The Youth Liberation Front also came with a large banner. I continued live-streaming the Antifa march on my phone in one hand while holding a GoPro attached to a stick in the other. Police kept so far back I couldn't see them. Some of the masked Antifa militants grabbed traffic cones and ran off. This was a sign of trouble. I continued walking and narrating what I saw to my Twitter followers. A Rose City Antifa member and an official media representative for the group walked near and stared at me. I tried to avoid eye contact. He has been arrested at numerous violent Antifa demonstrations in Portland since 2017. At the time, he had an upcoming trial for alleged criminal harassment of a Portland City employee he claimed was a fascist. I pressed onward. The protesters made a turn and marched in front of the Multnomah County Justice Center. This was the same area where, in 2016, I witnessed a man being pursued by an Antifa mob. He was prosecuted and convicted for brandishing his handgun to stop the mob from chasing him. After I was kicked, punched repeatedly on the head, and robbed of my camera equipment, I stumbled away to sit on the ground outside a nearby courthouse. "Where the hell were you?" I asked the police medic team who arrived. I raised my voice. They informed me that I needed to walk back to the Justice Center, where an ambulance would pick me up in front of the central precinct. Traffic was shut down by rioters, and the police medic team needed to rush to another part of downtown to aid officers. Bernstein, the BuzzFeed reporter, agreed to escort me to the police station. He had flown all the way from New York to work on a story about journalists who write about hate crime hoaxes. I knew of his left-wing bias, but remained hopeful he would see that I wasn't the far-right caricature my detractors accused me of being. The morning of, we spoke at length over breakfast in a downtown cafe. I knew his catalogue of reports included hit pieces on right-wing people, but I admired Bernstein's professionalism and friendliness. He wore a bulletproof vest and brought along a Kevlar helmet. I thought it was excessive. I told him Antifa generally harass and shove journalists, not try to kill them. I would regret my naivete a few hours later. The 7 minutes it took to walk to the police station felt interminable. My face was burning from the substances seeping into my facial abrasions. Bernstein recalled this moment in his BuzzFeed feature that was published 3 weeks later. The focus of the story was no longer on journalists who write about hate crime hoaxes, but rather the events of the day. At the police station, two paramedics put Noah on a stretcher. As they loaded him into the back of the ambulance, I noticed he was using Twitter. Noah asked that the paramedics let me ride along. I realized now, with the GoPro gone and the Federalist stringer nowhere to be found, that I was the crucial media witness to his victimization. I climbed up front and we rode up into the hills of southwest Portland to the Oregon Health and Science University Hospital. Indeed, I was on Twitter to see if any witnesses had captured video or photographs of my assailants. I wanted justice. At the hospital, I was moved on a stretcher into a room in the emergency department. Bernstein came with me. I naively viewed him as a guardian of sorts. He was the only person near me during the beating who wasn't laughing or cheering. But he was there only to gather information for his reporting. Before he left, he asked me if all this was worth it. "No," I responded. He, along with my detractors, took the cynical view that I secretly wanted the beating for fame. Quick drying cement? The emergency room was busy that afternoon. I later found out that other people injured by the ongoing riot were treated there. One patient in the room nearest to where I was waiting began shouting. The woman with him yelled for help. A team of nurses and doctors rushed in. I don't know what happened, but I could see blood and other bodily fluids on the ground. By now, several hours had passed without a doctor examining me. I mistook this to mean that I must have been okay. All I could think about was wanting to shower. The liquids on my face and hair had long ago dried and hardened. My vision was slightly blurry. I began to think about how much all this medical care was going to cost. Unknown to me at the time, conservative activist Michel Malkin started a GoFundMe campaign on my behalf. I was eventually wheeled into another room where I was given a CAT scan of my head. By now, some of the local reporting on the day's riot was published. The Portland police also released numerous updates throughout the day. Their press release read, "During today's events, there were multiple assaults reported, as well as projectiles thrown at demonstrators and officers. There were also reports of pepper spray and bear spray being used by people in the crowd. Officers deployed pepper spray during the incident. There were reports of individuals throwing milkshakes with a substance mixed in that was similar to a quick drying cement." Most people became fixated on the claim from police that some of the shakes used to assault people may have had some form of quick-drying cement mixed in. This led to an intense back and forth between the police and journalists sympathetic to Antifa, who sought to disprove the claim. A police report written that day by Lieutenant Richard Stainbrook stated that during the riot, a woman who was covered in a thick liquid told him the shake was filled with quickrete, a concrete mix. Cement has a high pH level and can cause burns on the skin. "I looked at the female and she was covered above her head and shoulders with a grey-coloured substance that was starting to dry. I have worked with concrete periodically and specifically quickrete, which is pre-mixed concrete, specifically many times," Stainbrook wrote. "The substance on the female smelled like quickrete. I also noticed as the substance was drying, it was turning into a chalky consistency, which, from my experience, is consistent with drying concrete." Left-wing journalists, like Katie Shepherd, formerly of Willamette Week, authored a light-hearted story where a team at the paper photographed themselves throwing restaurant-purchased milkshakes mixed with quickrete on a mannequin. The mayor's senior advisor on public safety stood by police and said that it was reported to him that a person hit with a shake reported having skin and eye irritation. However, the Portland police ultimately said they did not retrieve a sample to test. Other than the field observation by the lieutenant and a threatening anonymous email to police that included a recipe for cement shakes, there was no conclusive evidence for the claim. The focus on this particular aspect after the riot was a red herring. I don't know what substances I was hit with that day. My face felt like it was burning, but I was also covered in cuts and abrasions. In past Antifa riots in Portland, some black bloc militants have filled balloons with urine, feces, and chemicals before launching them at targets using slingshots. milkshaking. Pop Mob was not subtle about the group's goal in distributing free milkshakes. Its leader is a member of the Industrial Workers of the World, a revolutionary Marxist and anarchist labor union. Pop Mob named their event Shake Back the Streets. The event was promoted with posters and a video ad showing a white liquid being thrown in the air. Hundreds of flyers distributed at a Timbers soccer game at Providence Park Stadium called for anti-fascists to come out to oppose fascist violence. All of this was a left-wing dog whistle for the act of milkshaking, where protesters throw and dump drinks on others to mark and humiliate them. Milkshaking first became a phenomenon in the United Kingdom during the European Parliament election in 2019, when Nigel Farage and others were assaulted in public. On social media, the assaults were nearly universally praised and celebrated by Labour Party voters, anti-Brexit campaigners, and the wider left, who viewed it as a new take on tomato throwing. The act was quickly appropriated by the American left. Eater, a popular food and dining website owned by Vox, described milkshaking as a non-violent form of dissent. Journalists who have defended or excused milkshaking have unsurprisingly never experienced being on the receiving end. On the surface, it looks relatively innocent. A dairy drink, or something approximating it, is thrown at someone to humiliate him or her and to ruin their clothing. However, journalists forget that thick, dense liquids are binding when they land directly in your eyes. On top of that, milkshaking performs the function of marking you as a target for everyone else to attack. And one can never know what exactly he or she is being doused with by a masked mob. Considering that the United Kingdom has some of the highest reported per capita cases of acid attacks in the world, it is disturbing the British left has been so willing to praise assaulting people with liquids. In my case, I suspect that many people who threw drinks and objects at me as I was stumbling away didn't actually know who I was. By that point, my face was already obscured by all the substances. The milkshake served the function of signalling to others that it was okay to hurt me. Subarachnoid hemorrhage. After hours of sitting and waiting on the stretcher in the emergency room, a doctor finally met me to explain the results of the X-ray. He said I had a subarachnoid hemorrhage. I was unfamiliar with that medical term. "You have a bleed on the top of your brain," he explained. Having no experience with brain or head injuries, I didn't comprehend the seriousness of the diagnosis. "So what happens next?" I asked. I assumed I would be discharged right away and told to take it easy. No. I was held in the hospital for an additional 24 hours under supervision. I had the hubris of most young people. I thought I was invincible. That night, I was moved to my own room. All I wanted was to sleep. The events of the day felt like they would never end. But the nurse told me I would be woken up every hour for cognitive and physical movement tests if I fell asleep. The hourly tests involved answering basic questions, tracking eye movement, and responding to physical commands. Hour by hour, I laid in bed thinking about what could motivate those who say they are defending people of colour to brutally beat a person of colour. The laughs of the mob, as it happened, kept playing in my mind. I cursed at myself for not holding onto my camera equipment more tightly when it was being yanked away. That video footage could have been key evidence in identifying my attackers. Even when I wanted to think about something else, or nothing else, the burning sensation on my swollen face and scalp kept bringing me back to the moment of the attack. In the time since the beating, I've been receiving ongoing treatment. The most challenging time was in the early weeks of recovery. In my first televised interviews on CNN and Fox News after the attack, my speech was slow and I stuttered and slurred words. I still feel emotional when I catch glimpses or screenshots of those interviews from New Day and Tucker Carlson Tonight, respectively. My face was bruised and cut, and I was shaking. I later learned that Bill Bradley, the leftist martial arts instructor who had bailed on me, was threatened for even being there with me at all. An anonymous Antifa account sent him a disturbing email. I understand that you felt that at the time you were doing the right thing by thinking you were protecting an innocent reporter, no, from the possibility of violence. However, you need to admit that taking this action last week was a mistake based on a lack of information, the email read. It proceeded to lay out options the Portland Antifa community were willing to give him. One solution you're considering right now is publicly denouncing anti-fascism and the actions of those people on July 29th. Let's go over how this would play out. This week, you issue a statement about standing for non-violence and say the actions of several people on Saturday were unjustified and wrong. You say that everyone deserves to feel safe in this city and you therefore cannot support the actions of Antifa attacking an innocent reporter. This alienates you from the majority of the community out here who understand the context of the situation, as they themselves know from experience what it feels like to have hate speech directed at them, who have to constantly look over their shoulder, who have had friends hospitalized thanks in part to the lies spread by Andy Ngo. Many people here will withdraw their membership and leave your gym, leaving bad reviews. Some people may even become angry at you for defending the legitimacy of fascist views and seek retribution on the reputation of the business itself. The second choice was to turn his gym into an Antifa training base. Another option is to publicly endorse anti-fascist actions as a legitimate form of community self-defense. This will bring you plenty of community support, but on the other hand will make your business a target for right-wing extremists, who may even come to attack your business in person, like they did recently with Cider Riot on May 1st. I can understand why you might be scared to take this stance and worried about the repercussions on your business. However, you will have the support of the community here to help pay for damages, as well as the opportunity to hold these people legally accountable if they do come with the intent to harm your members or damage your property. The email closed with the following statement. You can learn a lot about someone based on the enemies they make over time. And right now you have the opportunity to take a stand against hatred in our community. Please consider who you want to publicly denounce and make your decision wisely. Bradley rejected the choices in the email and also refused to denounce me. In the time since, Antifa activists in Portland have tried to ruin his business's reputation with lies. Behind the violence. My recovery path, which is ongoing, involved physical, speech, cognitive, and occupational therapies. I had vision issues and deficiencies in memory and balance. And most challenging of all, I had a debilitating and paradoxical fear of both being around people and being alone. While walking to a grocery store or back to my car, I kept having flashbacks, fearful that someone could run up from behind to strike my head again. I didn't want to leave my home anymore, but Antifa knew where I lived. In describing these fears to my cognitive therapist, she responded, "It sounds like PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder?" I thought that condition was reserved for people who experience war, rape, and other horrors. She referred me to a specialist. The violence myself and others experienced at the hands of Antifa is not confined to that day or even their riots in general. Their lust for violence is so extreme that they've even beaten their own on accident. On August 4th, 2018, Antifa Black Bloc militants beat a leftist ally at one of their protests using a spring-loaded club. Why? Paul Welch made the mistake of carrying an American flag. They thought he was a conservative and beat him on the head. He was left, laying in a pool of blood dripping from his head. I hit the ground and was dazed. I realized within a few seconds that some of these people were kicking me as well. I was trying to protect my head, Welch says. Indeed, both the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Bureau of Investigation began warning state and local law enforcement in early 2016 that left-wing extremists associated with Antifa are increasingly engaging in domestic terrorist violence. And though violence is one of the defining features of their organizing tactics, it is second to their ideology. Antifa tactics will adapt and change over time in different contexts, but their extremism is constant. In an August 2019 on-camera interview with Rose City Antifa, NBC reporter Dasha Burns directly asked a masked member about the group's violent street actions. We see fascism as an inherently violent ideology, so when we disrupt its organizing, we see that as self-defense, the man answered. He was wearing sunglasses and a black hoodie printed with a professionally designed Rose City Antifa emblem. So you're saying that when far-right groups come here and throw demonstrations and rallies, they don't necessarily have to throw the first punch in order for you to react violently? Burns asked. He doesn't answer yes or no. The purpose of these groups coming to Portland is to attack people. The implication in his answer is that preemptive violence is warranted. The short interview was a rare opportunity to hear from the camera-shy militants who otherwise have a hostile and sometimes violent relationship with reporters. Rose City Antifa stands out as one of the few militant Antifa groups in the United States willing to engage with media in pre-arranged sit-down interviews. Their unofficial spokespeople dress in black bloc and speak eloquently. They're experienced at dodging questions that bring attention to their violent extremism. In that NBC interview, the masked interviewee never referred to their militant actions as violence. He was careful to label them self-defense, even when the reporter asked him about Antifa assaulting people with weapons and projectiles. This line has been carefully towed by Rose City Antifa since scrutiny was brought to bear on their actions following high-profile riots in 2017. We are unapologetic about the reality that fighting fascism at points requires physical militancy, Rose City Antifa posted in a statement on its Facebook in 2017. Anti-fascism is, by nature, a form of self-defense. The goal of fascism is to exterminate the vast majority of human beings. Street violence and Project Veritas. From 2016 to 2019, Americans were given a preview into what organized street violence by Antifa looks like. Every few months, mass brawls broke out, usually in a downtown area of a few cities on the west and east coasts. Most of these incidents occurred in Portland, which by 2017 gained a reputation for being the epicenter of American Antifa street violence. Through those years, I got to see up close with my own eyes some of the tactics they used to carry out mass violence. The plan was simple. Announce a gathering to oppose some alleged right-wing event, come in black bloc, and use weapons like pepper spray, batons, bats, sticks, and brass knuckles. You'll notice that firearms are not on that list. This does not mean that some individuals don't come armed. They most definitely do, but Antifa's goal generally does not include carrying out mass casualties, at least not for now. They recognize that they are working at a disadvantage against the state. Their comrades who kill others will be prosecuted and their whole networks jeopardized in the process. The US government has a good track record of identifying, prosecuting, and jailing far-left terrorists, so much so that young people today aren't even aware of the history of far-left terrorism in the United States during the 1960s and 1970s. And the left-wing bias of the media certainly tries to hide that history by focusing only on far-right extremism. The FBI, in conjunction with local police departments, was able to arrest members of terrorist communist groups like the Black Panther Party, Weather Underground, and the May 19th Communist Organization, among others. By the 1980s, these groups' organizational activities were severely disrupted. Antifa valorize these past extremists and share many of the same goals of overthrowing the government, but they also learned not to repeat the mistakes that led to their arrests. The plan now is to create a decentralized system of cells and affinity groups who share in the same ideology through disseminated propaganda and literature. They recognize that accelerationist tactics like mass killings of police or political opponents are too high risk. The goal is to inflict maximum damage without death and to maintain the momentum of riots to drain government resources and law enforcement morale. It costs little money to buy bear mace, brass knuckles, or batons. They can deploy a whole army to carry out smaller-scale assaults and vandalism at riots, making it difficult for police to make arrests and to maintain the illusion that Antifa has killed no one. This is meant to mislead the public into thinking Antifa aren't dangerous. Few seem aware Antifa specifically train for street violence. The media coverage on Antifa almost always focuses on how they're not organized or not a group. It is not a coincidence that a large group of militants dressed in the same uniform know how to coordinate mass attacks on people and property. Project Veritas, the investigative media organization, did what I thought was impossible. They successfully managed to infiltrate Rose City Antifa. From 2017 to 2018, Project Veritas sent an undercover journalist into the shadowy organization. He got in for a time. His written reports and videos, which to date are the only content leaked from a formal Antifa group, provide some of the first glimpses into how prospective Antifa members are recruited, radicalized, and trained. In June 2020, Project Veritas released the first video in its series called #ExposeAntifa. The video expose is narrated by a masked journalist going by the moniker Lion. His face and identity were withheld for safety reasons. Besides cooperating with law enforcement, Antifa see betrayal as the second mortal sin. In the narrated video, Lion wears a branded black RCA hoodie. Since 2017, Rose City Antifa members sometimes wear their branded merchandise at riots and protests, and also during media interviews. Part of it is for propaganda purposes. It increases recognition for the group within Portland and also helps establish camaraderie among members. They're a gang. The design features the Antifa Two Flags logo within a cutout of the state of Oregon with the words "Fighting Fascism Since 2007" next to a red rose. In the Project Veritas video, Lion opens up by saying, I've been undercover with Rose City Antifa since July of... Censored audio. Depending on the setting, if I were to be caught or found out, it could escalate to violence against me. That's quite an understatement. The video shows clips from secret trainings conducted at the In Other Words Feminist Community Center, a now defunct radical feminist bookstore and community space. Founded in 1993 by a Portland State University sociologist and two women's health activists, the store gained notoriety as a filming location for the IFC comedy show Portlandia. On the show, Fred Armisen and Carrie Brownstein played two humorless feminist bookstore staffers. The gag proved far too accurate, and the store publicly banned the show from filming in 2016, accusing it of being racist, contributing to gentrification, and being transmisogynistic. Though, In Other Words, had a reputation as a beloved, quirky Portland establishment, it lent its space to extremist causes behind doors. The Project Veritas investigation exposed this for the first time. During a 2017 training session at the bookstore, a Portland bartender instructed prospective Rose City Antifa members to hide their weapons from police. "Don't be that fucking guy with the goddamn spike brass knuckles getting photos taken of you," he said. "Police are going to be like, 'Perfect, we can prosecute these fuckers. Look how violent they are.' And not that we aren't, but we need to fucking hide that shit." At another point, Shifuni told members to practice things like an eye gouge, because it takes very little pressure to injure someone's eyes. The shocking words from the secret recordings told me what I suspected, based on my observations of Antifa's militaristic formations and fighting tactics. They are trained to hurt and maim. RCA and groups like them either attract or create violent offenders out of people. Most, if not all, carry a concealed weapon with them at times, wrote Lyon at the time in internal documents provided exclusively to me. Lyon was required to attend self-defense training to be part of Antifa's direct action street confrontations. That's where he and others were instructed to destroy the enemy. "Consider destroying your enemy, not like delivering a really awesome right hand, right eye, left eye blow, you know," he said in another secret recording to Antifa members at the bookstore. "It's not boxing. It's not kickboxing. It's like destroying your enemy." Bookstores. Using a radical bookstore as a front for extremist Antifa training isn't unique to Portland. In fact, a whole network of bookstores and community centers exist for this purpose. The most well-known one is the Slingshot Collective. On its website, visitors can view all affinity spaces broken down by continent. I recommend readers check out the website to see which extremist spaces may be in operation in their state or city. In Other Words was part of this network before it shut down. While it's not surprising that radical far-left bookstores exist on the liberal coasts of the United States, red states aren't immune. In fact, one of the most important regional Antifa hubs is in the American South. Firestorm Cafe and Books, a worker-owned far-left bookstore and meeting space in Asheville, North Carolina, is the Southeast's mecca for anarchists. Some of the books they proudly display in the front of the shop include Mark Bray's Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook, and also the Antifa Comic Book by Gord Hill. And like, In Other Words, it does not have a sustainable business model. But that's by design. Selling books does not seem to be the primary purpose of the bookstore. It is a space for comrades to meet one another and to be introduced to extremist ideologies. Firestorm has a sustainers program whereby people commit to giving donations each month. In Other Words, sustained itself for years through large donation drives, but ultimately ran out of fuel once it lost its sweetheart deal with Portland State, which for many years gave the store a monopoly on selling feminist textbooks to students. Asheville stands out in the southeast for its leftist politics, hippie character, and art scene. That type of political climate allows Firestorm to operate with public support, but some residents have been trying to raise the alarm about the bookstore's alleged role in a growing crime wave. In November 2019, concerned residents spoke at a meeting for the Council of Independent Business Owners in West Asheville. The residents accused Firestorm of using its needle exchange program to bring in criminality and vagrancy in an effort to reverse gentrification. "It's no accident, in my opinion, that you've got a bookstore fronting for an act of anarchy executed through the needle exchange program," said John Mile, a city employee at the meeting. Antifa's glorification of crimes and chaos is part of its ideology. They believe in destabilizing communities in order to delegitimize the authority of the local government. In turn, they set up their own mutual aid programs as alternatives to fool the public into believing the state is ineffective in meeting their basic needs. Beyond the southeast, another prominent bookstore in the Slingshot Collective is Wooden Shoe Books in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Inside the shop, it has a large mural on the ceiling showing black people in chattel slavery being abused by whites. The shop operates as a 501c3 charity and heavily promotes donation links on its website. A friend who visited the shop was recommended Bray's Antifa Handbook by staff. The second hashtag expose Antifa video released by Project Veritas shows clips from Inside the Base, an anarchist political center in Brooklyn, New York. By day, it ostensibly operates as a bookstore, but the space is popular for running a program to write fan letters to jailed Antifa comrades, who they call political prisoners. Another political prisoner, supported by that Antifa prison network, is David Campbell, an Antifa Black Bloc militant convicted for his role in stalking and choking a 56-year-old Jewish Trump supporter outside a conservative event in Manhattan. The victim was injured so badly that he wasn't breathing when first responders arrived. He later regained consciousness. Campbell was also accused of assaulting an NYPD officer during the arrest. He pleaded guilty to 2 counts of felony assault and was sentenced to 18 months in prison in October 2019. A source with knowledge within the NYPD says Campbell refused to cooperate with investigators per the Antifa rule that they can never speak to cops. Campbell's violent cause is championed by Antifa around the country. A benefit concert was held to support him in January 2020, and a Free David Campbell website currently takes donations on his behalf. Other Antifa-sympathizing bookstores don't just act as a library for extremist literature and propaganda. Some also host Antifa training sessions, including trainings on how to injure people in street fights. "If you get a good liver or kidney shot, it's pretty much crippling to them," said an Antifa fight instructor named Chris at the base in the Project Veritas video. "If you break one of the floating ribs," he points to the spot on the abdomen, "those are also very painful. It's hard to move after that. It's hard to catch a breath." In the background, exercise training equipment like weights and mats can be seen. What does one need those for in a bookstore? The trainer continues, "One good body shot could potentially give you all the time in the world to run away while they're doubled over in pain, or really put a beating on them after that, if you really don't like the person." Chris makes the criminal intent of the training clear in another clip. "We want to, in this space, reframe the idea of self-defense." Of note, beyond where the training is taking place is also who is participating. One of the men practicing punches in the undercover video is Andrew Gitlitz, a New York-based writer and producer of the Antifada Anarchist Communist podcast. He writes under the name A.M. Gitlitz. Gitlitz has written for the New York Times opinion section, Salon, Vice, and other publications. In 2017, the New York Times published an essay by Gitlitz for its Red Century series, which honored the legacy of the Russian Revolution. I reached Gitlitz for comment on Twitter, but he did not respond. To be fair, teaching others how to incapacitate someone isn't out of place in a self-defense class. Even comments about making a target kneel over in pain can be fitting in the right self-defense training context. But when this is coupled with an ideology that teaches adherents to destroy political opponents by any means necessary, it becomes a combination for violent criminality and terrorism. It never ends with just fistfighting or street brawls. Guns. According to Lyons' reports on Rose City Antifa, prospective members were also told to train in handling and firing firearms. They trained at the Place to Shoot gun range in North Portland. The gun range did not respond to a request for comment. Further, in the third hashtag Expose Antifa video released by Project Veritas, a female infiltrator details how she went undercover in 2018 in the Shelby, North Carolina chapter of Redneck Revolt. Redneck Revolt is an Antifa militia-style group that is closely linked with its Pacific Northwest offshoot, the John Brown Gun Club. Redneck Revolt was founded in 2009 and gained national media prominence starting around 2017 when it was present at Antifa events and protests in a support role. Its members wear military-style gear and open-carry pistols and semi-automatic rifles. They're unapologetic about intimidating opponents. They call themselves anti-fascist, anti-capitalist, anti-nation-state, and pro-gun. They see themselves as revolutionaries. In other words, they are armed Antifa who have the training to kill. Clips in the video show a Redneck Revolt member named Matt interviewing the undercover woman as part of the initiation process. If an officer of the state came to the door and asked you questions about your political ideology and people you associate with, how would you respond? He asks, testing to see if the woman is able to hide her extremist beliefs and connections to the militia. If you were tabling at a gun show and someone loudly accused you of being a terrorist or part of Antifa, how would you handle it? He asked her next. The Shelby Redneck Revolt chapter eventually announced on Facebook it was splitting off from the national group because the organization adopted an internal culture that espouses capitalist characteristics. From this day forward, we will be known as Carolina Workers Collective. We hereby recommit ourselves to building communities of mutual aid and defense among the poor and working class in our larger community. We stand against the state. We stand against white supremacy. We stand against patriarchy. We will actively work to dismantle the harmful capitalist and hierarchical system that exists in our culture. Shortly after, the Project Veritas infiltrator was kicked out after raising security suspicions among other members. They confronted the woman on Signal, an encrypted peer-to-peer messaging app used by Antifa. She was asked to not return to their meetings. I asked the woman in an interview if the people she got to know in the group were willing to kill for their cause. Her answer was unequivocal. Yes. This is the reason they train with firearms, she continued. They view themselves as armed protectors of minorities and the disenfranchised. This was borne out in reality when they acted as security for Chaz in Seattle. The woman showed me documents and literature she acquired during her time in the group. One booklet she was given was titled Colouring Book for Revolutionaries. The booklet features sketches of communist activist Angela Davis, a Black Power fist, Rafael Sebastian Guillen Vicente, the Mexican anarchist communist insurgent, and other left-wing idols. The childlike presentation of the radical literature mirrors one of Antifa's strategies. They hide their extremism behind a mask of banality or innocence. This extends to their violence as well. If you follow Antifa as a subject on social media, you've probably seen the right-wing meme that portrays them as weak and effeminate. This meme bothered me long before my own experience of being assaulted by them. It falsely portrays all Antifa as harmless paper tigers. This is wrong. Some Antifa are athletic and train in street fighting, as documented in the undercover videos. Those who are less athletic can use the weapons described above. And anyone can be trained to use a firearm. It is a catastrophic mistake to assume Antifa aren't capable of mass carnage. This is not a movement that follows the rules of engagement. They go for the eyes, the genitals, whatever it takes to bash the fash. If that means mobbing an individual in a 20-on-1 scenario, they'll do it. And if it involves killing for their cause, they're willing to do it as well.